With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. Trish Wood here on The Fringe. Yes, on TNT Radio. And we're going to switch things up a little bit in our first hour today because we have a really interesting guest, and she's been involved with the Better Way Conference in Bath, England that TNT Radio is involved in proudly. And we've only got her for a couple minutes because she's doing important stuff. But there was a kind of a breakthrough idea that happened at the conference and before, but it's something I think we can probably get through with her in the short amount of time that we have before she's got to run, but I really wanted to do this. And then I'll do my usual spiel at the top. I've got a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about today, including the mayoralty race in Toronto and Gay Pride Month. It might as well be Gay Pride Year at this point, and a whole bunch of other stuff. But right now we're going to throw to Dr. Sabine. I hope it's pronounced Hazen. It could be Hazan. Do forgive me, doctor, if I'm getting it wrong, and correct me. And there's a ton of stuff to talk to you about involving gut health and the gut biome, which I don't know so much about. But what interested me just for our 10 minutes is the idea that you have discovered in some of your research that the vaccines, if I'm getting this correctly, may be causing harm because they are ameliorating the biome in our stomach that keeps us healthy. Am I even kind of on a playing field on that analysis of what you're saying?
So we looked at a study where we took patients before and after vaccination, and we looked at their microbiome before and after. And what was interesting is that we noticed that there was a bacteria, which is the bacteria that's in your probiotics, right? That bacteria in your gut decreased within 50%, by 50% within a month. And then as we followed a few of those patients, we discovered that that bacteria kept on dropping at 5 months to 9 months. So there was a persistent damage that we noticed in a few patients, which basically, brought the question of, is the vaccine killing your bifidobacteria when it's supposed to be improving your immunity, right? And so we started looking at patients that were, and that, by the way, was brought on because early on when vaccines were pushed, people were having side effects. And I'm not the type of person that doesn't listen to my patients. I actually paid attention. They were fine before. You know, you talk about gastroenterologist Dr. Denise Hertz, who was basically top of her game, taking care of patients in Beverly Hills. All of a sudden, after the vaccine gets debilitated, the first thing we noticed in her was the loss of bifidobacteria, completely wiped out. Her gut was desolate. So one wonders whether maybe the loss of bifidobacteria is what's causing people to have COVID after they've had a couple boosters, to have side effects, neurological problems, etc. So this is what we've been noticing.
Okay, so just pretend you're speaking to an infant who knows nothing about this, because I really want to not miss the importance of what you're saying. Sometimes it's easy to get bogged down in the science and not see the big picture. And what I'm trying to understand is that if this bacteria is wiped out, what is the downside of that? How is that deleterious for people who don't understand the way that good gut bacteria actually work? How would it manifest itself?
So, you have to start with the foundation that immunity is in your gut, right? So immunity is in your gut. What does that mean? That means there's good microbes in your gut that are helping you, and there are bad microbes that are not helping you. And it's really about the balance in your microbiome, right? When we talk about microbiome, which is just, a fancy term for your poop, when you look at the toilet, that poop is really trillions of bugs, viruses, bacteria, all mingling together, right? When you lose a certain group of microbes, you lose the balance. Your system is out of whack in a way, right? So what happens is viruses now, if you lose the good bacteria, viruses are allowed to penetrate. So it's called, it's a condition we call dysbiosis, imbalance of the microbiome. And when you have that imbalance, which means loss of good bacteria, high bad bacteria, viruses penetrate. So the idea comes from, and what we've seen with COVID is that people with severe COVID had zero bifidobacteria, and people with that were exposed to COVID but never got COVID, high risk, had a lot of bifidobacteria. So bifidobacteria is, you know, you have to start thinking of, well, who else has loss of bifidobacteria? Crohn's patients, naive Crohn's patients, Lyme patients, you know, they've been put on multiple antibiotics. Now, is it the Lyme that came in, created an autoimmune reaction and killed the bifidobacteria, or is it the antibiotics they were given for so long that killed their bifidobacteria? So then the other thing that we just published and actually submitted at Digestive Disease Week, presented it last month, was loss of bifidobacteria in invasive cancer. So when you look at that, you have to say, okay, well, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did people have invasive cancer and then kill their bifidobacteria? Or did the bifidobacteria create a bed of allowing bad microbes to come in that creates, you know, cancer? Some of us, you know, believe that cancer is microbes. You know, there's going to be a time when we're going to start discovering that a lot of these cancers are microbes. Think about HPV with cervical cancer. Think about H. pylori with gastric cancer. So it's just a matter of time till we discover, you know, colon cancer is a microbe. Bladder cancer is a microbe. You know, prostate cancer is a microbe. It's just a matter of time till, you know, the scientists and the doctors start focusing that way, right? Once we discover that, it's going to be interesting to look back and say, well, maybe it all started with an imbalance in the microbiome, which allowed those microbes to come in.
I always think globally about these things, being a former science reporter. And I'm wondering, do you hypothesize, and feel free to blue sky a bit here, I won't hold you to it, but that lifestyle in general and the garbage food we eat and the stress we live under, just basically the fact that Western civilization is super unhealthy right now, is that, do you put that into the equation for the wiping out of these bacteria, this bifidobacteria specifically that you're talking about? I mean, could it just be that we're mean to our guts in the way we live? Sorry?
Go ahead. I said possibly, right? But the thing is, the reality is, when you do look at the microbiome, like I've looked at thousands and thousands of samples of stools, you start noticing that there's some people that actually eat garbage and they're fine. Their microbiome is fine. So, and there's some people that eat super healthy and their microbiome is trashed, right? So, and those are the people that come and say, well, I've done everything right. How could I have this? How could my microbiome be out of whack, right? There is such a thing as a resilience, right? There is such a thing as a resilience microbiome. And that's what we're looking at right now. We're looking at what allows a person to eat crap and have a great microbiome, and what allows another person to eat healthy and have a crap microbiome, right? So it's all in the resilience. And resilience is multifactorial. It's not just the microbiome, you know? It could be in part with your genetics. So
I just want to get back to the vaccine before we lose you, because I think that's a really important finding. And these kind of studies, they're always batted away by the people who push vaccines, and they start looking for ways to criticize the study. But I find that a good way to kind of look at them is to say, mechanistically, what would it have been about the vaccine that would have done that? Is it the autoimmune response itself caused in that way that would have created this bacteria to disappear? Is that possible? Or
I don't know. You know, I think, you know, this was an observation. Yes. I mean, you know, I'm the most critical person of my own research myself. You know, it's a small study. Yes, we need to do a bigger study. But the fact is, we have hundreds of patients that are vaccine injured, and we're finding exactly what we expected, right? in the gut, which is kind of seeing this data that we're showing of loss of bifidobacteria. So you put two and two together and you look at the vaccine injured and you look at the people before and after and loss of bifidobacteria. And you also ask people around, you know, when people listen to my lectures and they hear about the loss of bifidobacteria, all of a sudden they come to me and they say, you know, doc, it makes sense now because I was vaccinated. My gut was fine. Now my gut is completely, you know, in a disaster. So, you know, people start realizing themselves, you know, like I have a guy yesterday, a plastic surgeon from Barbados who basically got vaccinated and he's constantly getting sick and he never used to get sick. So listening to my lecture, he basically put two and two together. And I think that's what's happening to a lot of doctors, right? They put two together when they see that there's a small data that shows something. So to answer your question, do we know what causes a bacteriophage? No, we don't. I mean, it could be a contamination in the vaccine. It could be the mechanism itself. You know, maybe the spike protein, maybe giving a spike protein was not a good idea. A loose spike protein in the blood that travels all the way to your colon. Maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe that spike protein is activating dormant viruses, you know? Maybe that spike protein is creating, you know, when you activate viruses, you create a bacteriophage. That's what viruses do, right? They kill the bacteria. They try to kill bacteria, right? So
I'm going to put you on the spot before we say goodbye and ask you this, because I know that our listeners are going to want to have this answer, because I'm sure they're thinking it, as am I. What is the one thing we can do in our lives? Is it how we ingest, what we avoid? What's the one thing we can do to be kind of taking care of that little garden of bacteria down there?
I think don't create a tornado in your life and don't create a life that's full of stress. I think the most thing that I can emphasize, you know, you always see people that have, you know, Crohn's disease, but there was like a story of parents get divorced and that was like, you know, tormented them. I think decreasing stress is the number one thing, in my opinion, decreasing anxiety. Sometimes you can decrease stress. You know, some people have a high, you know, movemented life, but as much as possible, try to create the balance in your life between, you know, working hard and playing hard and resting. I think that's the most important lesson. The second lesson is nutraceuticals, you know, the nutrients. Give nutrients to your body. You know, if you're vitamin D deficient, supplement your vitamin D. If you're vitamin C deficient, supplement your vitamin C. You know, so vitamins are very important. Zinc, you know, vitamin C and vitamin D increases bifidobacteria. Zinc increases lactobacillus, which is a great symbiotic bug to bifidobacteria. So I think, you know, that's the first thing. That's the second thing. The third thing is exercise, you know, sun, go out, play in the garden, play with the dirt, you know, touch the dirt. You know, expose yourself to microbes, not necessarily go bathe in a mud pie where pigs are, but playing with dirt, you know, gardening. And you can do that in your apartment. You can do that in your, you know, outside in your backyard. So I think, you know, getting out there more, you know, there's studies, if you look back at the kids that were in kindergarten that played in a garden versus kids that stayed in the classroom, the kids that played in the garden had less infections and less viruses than the kids that stayed in the classroom. So I think that's a good little lesson for people to take on. I think leave medications when you need them, you know, so, you know, don't jump and panic and be anxious to take those pills to protect yourself from something that may not even affect you. Same thing with, you know, probiotics. Some probiotics are good. Some probiotics may be dead bacteria. Some probiotics may not even have that probiotic, that bacteria in there, and some may not reach the colon. So really develop your own, make your own yogurt, learn how to ferment food, eat foods that are, you know, high in fermentation, sauerkraut, you know, kimchi, you know, kombucha, all that, to kind of recreate a fermentation in your colon. So you become a bifidobacteria maker instead of depending on a pill that, you know, may not be the right pill. How many patients have I seen that take probiotics that actually have zero bifidobacteria in their gut because either the probiotic they're taking is the wrong probiotic for them and killing their gut, or it never reaches the gut, or it's just not there. There's nothing in there. So I think it's important to be self-sufficient and to learn how to get ourselves back without paying attention to all the media, the drama, and kind of decrease the stress. That's the best, you know, turn off that TV, stop listening to the media that sells you, you know, products after products, and just trust your gut, follow your instinct.
You know what? I think you're absolutely right. I did see a story about outbreaks, very bad outbreaks of this thing. I think it's called a Singtel virus, and specifically in Australian kids during lockdown because they weren't being exposed to anything that was beefing up their immune system. I shudder to think what the school closures have done to the gut health of our children, but that's probably for another show. Thank you so much absolutely. For doing this. So grateful. How do you pronounce your last name? Do say it for me, please.
Hazen.
Your last Hazen, Dr. Sabine Hazen. Very grateful. Thank you so much. Have
Thank
a good day.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye. Yeah, so interesting, right? It was really worth getting her on, even if just for that short time, because to me, every little piece of information about the vaccines and how they affected us and what they did and didn't do are important. And especially if you're following this Jamie Foxx story, let me just say this too, because I never talk about anecdotal stories of vaccine injury specifically. I've been really, really careful about only talking about stories that you can really trace a cause and effect, especially movie stars. But the Jamie Foxx story is really interesting because he's gone apparently from having this serious, mysterious illness to a rehab facility in Chicago. Rehab, not the drug and alcohol kind, but maybe the brain injury kind seems to be what they're saying. And there are stories out there that this may have been related to a shot he was forced to take on set. These are rumors I am trafficking in, which is not how I normally do this program. But here's why that's an important story. I'll say it. Because in Hollywood is super, super, super COVIDian, right? I am in that business. I know what they require on sets. Everybody's masked. Everybody's paranoid. They vaccine passports, the whole nine yards. If you are not COVIDian in Hollywood, you don't work. So if you are vaccine injured, they're going to just think you're a conspiratorial MAGA hat wearing nut. That's kind of how things play out. So if Mr. Fox is vaccine injured, and I pray that it's not that, and I pray that he will recover from this because he's such an important guy and such a great actor. But if it is true, he likely won't be able to say anything about it. All the people around him who rely on him for financial support, his agents, his managers, lawyers, maybe his family, I don't know, will be saying, don't talk about it. So it's a very interesting story. And as I say, I'm trafficking in some reasonably good information, but obviously we're not getting it from the horse's mouth or even his medical people directly. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Anyway, we're going to go to a break and then we're going to come back with more of On the Fringe on TNT Radio.
You should hear what Katie Hopkins is talking about.
And Serbia still once believes, has a right to believe, I would have thought, that Kosovo belongs to the Serbs. There were local elections recently, and the Serbs boycotted the elections in Kosovo because the Serbs believe Kosovo still belongs to them. So the turnout at the local elections, just so you know, was 3.47%. That is less, would you believe, than even the local elections in the UK. 3%. So virtually no one turned out. The Albanians therefore took control and have installed the Albanian mayors into Kosovo. And so there's a huge fight going on because all Serbs can see that this is a load of nonsense. Novak was trying to highlight that. And now Kosovo wants him to be punished. The Federation stated it would contact the French Tennis Federation and seek punishment for Djokovic. What absolute turnips.
Katie Hopkins on TNT Radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tess Laurie, and I'd like to invite you to this year's Better Way Conference. Join more than 50 international speakers and our host, Neil Oliver, as they unveil how we can take back our health, freedom, and sovereignty. Watch inspiring, empowering, uplifting live conversations and attend workshops with world-renowned health professionals, activists, and journalists. This year's speakers include James Corbett, Matthias Desmet, Laura Aberley, Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Jessica Rose, and Vera Sharav. We'll be discussing solutions to the World Health Organization monopoly power grab, fake food, the climate agenda, artificial intelligence and transhumanism, big pharma corruption, and much, much more. If you are questioning the events of the last 3 years and want to be part of real and positive change, come to the Better Way Conference in the first weekend of June. You can attend online or in person in the historic UK city of Bath. Join us, brothers and sisters. Be part of this growing international community with a vision for a better way. Join the warriors fighting to save humanity and our planet. Visit betterwayconference.org for tickets and information. Your ticket purchase supports the groundbreaking work of the World Council for Health. See you there.
Proudly supported by TNT Radio.
To follow us on Twitter,
just follow these easy steps.
Click the link on our site.
Follow me.
Follow me.
Follow me, guys.
Or search on Twitter.
TNT Radio Live.
TNT Radio.
Yeah, Trish Woodback, I don't think I've ever said that I have a Twitter account. You probably assumed I do because I'm opinionated. And that's where lots of opinions are said for good and for ill. And my way to see my tweeting, my timeline, as they say, is at Wood Reporting. And I tweet a lot about media issues. I tweet a lot about censorship. I tweet a lot about COVID-19 and focus protection and the people I've met in the last 3 years that I've been reporting almost exclusively on COVID-19. Here, but originally on my podcast, Trish Wood is Critical, and we were debunking the narrative as far back as March of 2020, and I did it because, gee, it was sort of easy. People say, Trish, how did you know that lockdowns were a bad idea and school closures were going to be a problem and that this was going to be a very, very difficult time? I'll tell you how I knew. It was so simple. And it involves critical thinking, which I ascribe to. I don't think you have to have a PhD, and maybe it's better if you don't have a PhD, because they're not thinking all that clearly right now, many of them. That is, it's two things. It was the age stratification from John Ioannidis. Very simple. He had a chart. We knew who COVID affected. 99.9% of the people in the world do not have a bad outcome from COVID-19. It was super, super stratified amongst old people and people with certain comorbidities. I am neither that old. And then actually I had no comorbidities. Now I do have one. I'm much heavier now because of COVID, right? I was sitting around my apartment being depressed about it and eating too much. So I'm on a plan. I'm losing the weight. I'm getting rid of it. But that was one of the things that I understood to be true. And it's actually how I met Mike Ryan of TNT. He interviewed me about how I figured it out and my experience with Tony Fauci back in the day, covering him as a science journalist during the AIDS times, where he also was, in my view, worthy of limited respect, if any. So that was one thing. It was age stratification. So I figured that out, what group I was in, where am I? And we were at no risk of dying of COVID-19. But the other part of it too was that I knew, and this was key, and again, this is just critical thinking, people. They were saying, coming back from touring China and getting the big kind of Potemkin village tour of how great the lockdowns were by the CCP, toured all around Wuhan. Oh, they work. We've driven COVID away by locking people in their apartments. I mean, imagine that. And Bruce Aylward came back, and he and other WHO officials and people, even in American government scientists and people in Western governments, were quoting what they perceived to be a death rate, right? As 3.4%. Think about that. 3.4% is really, really, really high. And I knew from my background in science reporting that the way that you determine the death rate from a pathogen is a fraction. And it's really simple. It's how many people got it and how many people of the people who got it died, right? That is called an infection fatality rate, an IFR, dead simple. right? So it's one top of the fraction is one number and the bottom of the fraction is another number. So that's the infection fatality. Then there's the case infection rate, the case fatality rate. And this is what they were throwing around as if it was the infection fatality rate. But the case fatality rate only includes people who've turned up at hospital or at their doctors saying, oh, I've got COVID. So to get the first number, you have to do a seroprevalence study to see how many people were infected that didn't seek medical treatment, et cetera, right? The people who were maybe even asymptomatic. That's how you get the broadest number. What they were doing was they were using a case fatality rate that only included the people who were sick enough to go to hospital or see their doctor. So those are people already super sick. It does not include the jillions of people who will have, which is to say most people will have not a bad outcome from COVID-19. So I knew that the 3.4% number was garbage, and I was really, really mad about it because I knew that if I could figure it out and others too, Jay Bhattacharya, all the smart people at Stanford who paid a very high price for being right, that there was something fishy going on, and that the number that they were saying that we should be afraid of, 3.4% of the population is going to die of COVID, was ridiculous. I knew that that was wrong. So that kind of got me going down the road of asking really critically informed questions about COVID-19. And I figured out pretty early on that lockdowns were going to do more harm than good, that public health was not even thinking critically about this. And I'll tell you something else that I heard from Scott Atlas, who I've spoken to many times and interviewed many times and like, and I've read his book as well. When he went to Washington, D.C. to be on the task force, invited there specifically by President Trump to do that, and he would sit in these meetings with Deborah Burke and Tony Fauci, they weren't doing any risk-benefit calculations at all about what they were doing. And they didn't even know, and he actually told me this story recently, that children, they wouldn't acknowledge that children were at very, very little risk of dying at COVID-19 unless they had comorbidities and quite serious comorbidities, right? They didn't know that. At that, so this is, we're well into 2020 at this point, and they still didn't know that. They kind of blew it off. The jury's still out, they said. We knew the stratification in March of 2020 when the lockdowns happened. So the whole thing was mismanaged so badly from just a pure public policy and science perspective, hurting healthy people, not properly protecting the actual vulnerable people, which is what you would expect to have happened. For some reason, we don't know why they went this route. There's all kinds of theories about why they chucked the pandemic plan that has been in place for a very long time. Donald Henderson was the guy behind it, a very famous guy credited with eliminating some viruses in his day. He died in 2016, sadly, so he couldn't fight this battle. But he said, if you close schools and lock down healthy people, you're going to create another catastrophe. And of course, that's what happened. We know that now, right? So I tell you this only to say that when these things happen in our lives around science or things that we think are complicated, climate change is the same. We can figure it out. Don't be cowed by thinking that the experts have the answers. Frequently, they don't. Groupthink is real. Saying what's good for your career is real. Understand that the vast majority of scientific studies in the world are funded by Tony Fauci's NIH. You can't do research if you are at odds with Tony Fauci. Understand that that's what was going on. And if you think that scientists would not sell their soul or would not get caught up in a bad idea, be kind of pushed into a bad idea, I don't know if they actually think, oh, I'm going to support Tony Fauci's bad ideas because I need his money. We're adults here. We know that it's never that cut and dried. It's not that much of a kind of a transactional relationship. But what it is a reluctance to think critically and think clearly about the person who is funding your life, right? So you can be pushed and prodded and slipping and sliding into all kinds of ideas that are absurd, which, like school lockdowns, were informed by the false idea that A, children get sick and die of COVID, which they don't, and B, that they're major carriers of the virus home, which they aren't either because they have a very low viral load. Both of those things were known. And for some reason, which I will never understand, my friend Jennifer Say, who's doing a documentary on this, she's the woman who quit working at Levi's as a big executive, turned down $1 million so that she could talk about school closures. I mean, we're all baffled by how this ended up happening, and we were using our children. The teachers' unions certainly were using our children as human shields, weren't they? So the next time there's a catastrophe and we're facing many, I mentioned the mayoralty race in Toronto, and I'll get to that in a minute, but there are a lot of complicated things going on right now, right? Media's corrupt, legacy media's corrupt for sure. TNT is a beacon of light in the midst of all that. That's one thing you can do, is continue to listen to us, but there's lots of good people writing on Substack, including Matt Taibbi and Cy Hirsch, who I recently interviewed about the Nord Stream pipeline scoop that he got. Michael Schellenberger's there. He's great on the environment. David Zweig has been great on COVID. Lots of good places to go and get information. So that's not insurmountable, although it's difficult. I think the bigger issue we have, and I'm going to do a show on this for you at sometime really soon, if I can find the right expert, and that is we are now facing, as citizens, the idea that our votes actually mean very, very little. And I'll tell you what I think about that. They mean little because the media is not accurately reporting to us what's happening in the world. So our views are a little bit skewed because we're always scrambling to find the right information. That's one way democracy is failing. But the other way is this. How can I put this? Elected officials, the people we vote for, go into office now knowing that they can bald-face lie to us. They now have their own agenda that does not reflect what we want to happen in our lives, right? They're not putting out questionnaires about how we feel about their dumb solutions to the so-called climate crisis. I didn't vote for windmills to rape the natural landscape or solar panel farms to ruin our hillsides. I mean, I didn't vote for any of that. I didn't vote for it. I don't want 15-minute cities. I don't want cars to be outlawed in cities, which they're doing in Toronto right now. There's all of these crazy things happening around the break in faith between elected officials in a democracy and the people they serve. They no longer serve our interests. I really believe that. I believe they think that we are worthy only of disdain. They get together in places like Davos and talk about all the big things they're going to solve that they believe are true. Again, it's kind of an infectious groupthink. And they also know that the results that are going to be hard on us, like these stupid 15-minute cities and all the other nonsense they're talking about, it's ruining our natural world, they are not going to have to struggle. Do you think that Jeff Bezos with his $500 million yacht is going to struggle, that he's not going to be able to fly his private jets around while airline prices for us are going through the roof? They just blocked in France, as I understand it, the ability to fly a short-haul flight for regular people. So the people who are doing this, the politicians and the global elites, have figured out that they can do what they want to us to solve the issues they want to solve in the way they want to solve them, and the democratic process means nothing. So we're going to take a break, and then I'm going to come back and talk to you a little bit about what I think the solution to that issue is. Obviously, one of the solutions is this conference that's going on in Bath right now, where people are exchanging all kinds of ideas about these things. And part of what happens at these conferences is that people feel really good being around other people who are experiencing the world in the same way. I find that when I go to these things to speak, and I do it a lot, the main comment I hear from people who listen to this show and my podcast is how happy they are to meet somebody who's kept them maybe a little bit sane during these times that are so very complicated. So people are happy to get together, and that's one thing we must start doing. But let's go to a break, and then I'll talk to you about some of my ideas about how we overcome what we are facing right now, and they're big issues. But if we keep our wits about us and keep thinking critically, we can do it. So let's take a break, and we'll be back in a minute.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
In a stark example of how far we've fallen as a society, a trio of teens between midnight and 3 a.m. on Memorial Day climbed the fence in Manlius, New York's town Swan Pond and stole four Signets and their mother, Faye. Adding insult to injury, the ringleader of the trio, 18-year-old Aman Hassan, brought the swan to his aunt, who proceeded to cook it up as a feast for their family. The two other boys haven't been identified because of their age, but Hassan was seen smirking at cameras and walking in handcuffs through the Manlius Police Department like he was some sort of criminal mastermind. Their apparent unrepentance is evidenced by the fact that the boys are claiming that they were hunting. Alternately, they're claiming that they did not know that it was a swan, that they did not know that it wasn't a wild animal, despite the fact that it was in a very well-defined, fenced-off, famous swan pond, replete with signs. Finally, they said that they didn't know that the swans were owned by the village of Manlius. All of these assertions beggar belief and cry out for punishment that will teach these boys a lesson. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
George Soros is one of the United States' top political and advocacy donors, spending billions on campaigns, think tanks, startups, and nonprofits that promote his agenda. His principal philanthropic network includes the Open Society Foundations and Foundation to Promote Open Society, two multi-billion dollar left-of-center grant-making foundations. Through these organizations, Soros has funded the vast majority of the most prominent left progressive advocacy groups in the United States. Financial ties between the Black Lives Matter movement and Soros have been reported, as well as financial ties to Occupy Wall Street through intermediaries like the Tide Center. The network of Soros-funded organizations indirectly touches 30 media organizations. George Soros spent tens of millions on political campaigns affiliated with the Democratic Party in 2016 and heavily supported Hillary Clinton. In the first 3 months of 2020, George Soros had put $28.3 million into various efforts to support the Democratic side in the 2020 election. In August 2021, Soros contributed $1 million to support California Governor Gavin Newsom in his recall election against Republican challengers.
Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Based on where he is putting his money, we can only conclude that George Soros hates America. Gavin Newsom? Really? I mean, oh. California's a failed state. It really is. Poor San Francisco, Los Angeles, people are leaving in droves. I don't know. Isn't it funny to experience that? Because we're all, it's like cognitive dissonance, right? Like, why are you destroying your own cities? Why are you, it's crazy. I don't know if I said this on the show, but I'm doing a film. We had a crew going down to the Twitter building in San Francisco to film something. And we couldn't get a crew to go. They said the local crews, the ones who shoot docs, the high profile, good, you know, people who know what they're doing. Said, well, I'd love to take the gig and do it, but you got to hire armed security for us to go down to the Twitter building. Seriously. And I thought, oh, you're just being a drama queen. This is just melodrama. What are you talking about? And then I did some research, and it's absolutely true. And what happens down at the Twitter building and in the area is that they know that these television crews, the documentary crews, And TV news crews carry very expensive gear that can be pawned and sold, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not just about stealing anymore. It's about violence. Apparently, one camera person, whatever work, I used to call them cameramen, but I guess that's not allowed. So DOP, director of photography, that's gender neutral, I guess, was followed home and shot. The person did a home invasion robbery, followed them home from that neighborhood near the Twitter building. So it is a thing. It's a very scary thing. And people are changing their lives around the fact that neighborhoods in American cities and Toronto too are becoming so violent and ugly and full of human poo and needles and drugs and fentanyl and the rest of it that they don't want to live there anymore. And the weird thing about it, this is what, there's so much wrong with that. I don't even know where to end. But to me, as an observer of society, the weirdest thing is that nobody seems freaked out about it, right? The politicians aren't saying, we're calling in the National Guard to help us clean up the homeless problem. We're going to get them all treatment and housed and get all this off the street. They're just slouching through it, to quote Joan Didion. It's very, very weird. And it's like when you see a big problem happening and people are pretending, it's like a dysfunctional family that's in denial, right? They're pretending it's not happening. So the people seeing it are feeling really disturbed, but they're more disturbed because the politicians are not addressing it head on. That seems to be what's happening in a lot of Western countries right now, right? So anyway, I just want to get back to what I was saying about being a citizen now, because I've been thinking long and hard about it, and I'm going to start getting involved in various enterprises that are dealing with this, because we cannot just, it's clear that democracy as it is working right now is a failure. They don't care what we want. And the media only supports a certain ideology, and that is the ideology that the politicians are doing, right? It's all very left-wing and super existentialist, climate changey, and super COVIDian. I mean, the constant mantra of safe and effective about a vaccine that was neither is still pervasive today. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But so democracy is not working for us. And I think we've walked through the idea that when you criticize democracy these days, you're accused of being, as our prime minister says, or Joe Biden says, you know, white supremacist, or as if populist is a bad idea. I don't know why that's I don't know why that's a pejorative term. It shouldn't be. But we have to stop being afraid of those things, of the epithets and the fake labels and all the stuff they say when they start losing the argument for a minute and a half. It's what Trudeau did to our wonderful truckers who had a legitimate protest on a legitimate issue, and he shut them down eventually with the jackboot of the Emergencies Act. So where does that leave us, and what do we do? I think the first thing we have to do is really acknowledge that that's what's going on now. We can't just walk into a voting booth and kind of close our eyes and, you know, pick someone who maybe says some of the right things and hope that it works and that the deep state doesn't stop them. I mean, look what they did to Trump when he had these very anti-regime change foreign policy edicts. And I saw him being interviewed the other night, and he's brilliant on Ukraine. He said, I have it sorted in 24 hours. He knows it's a total disaster. Everybody knows Ukraine is a complete disaster, for the Ukrainians especially. Zelensky is a cokehead grifter who will leave there with a massive bank account and a villa in either Croatia or Miami. That's what's going to happen. The country's ruined. Tens of thousands, probably more people are dead. Well, if you include maimed, hundreds of thousands are maimed. Cities are ruined, right? And we don't seem to be able to stop it. Most sane people, you know, the idea of, oh, Ukraine flag waving, I'm putting that in my Twitter bio, that's kind of over. I think people are really starting to wake up, given the amount of money that's gone there, including from Canada. I think they're starting to wake up. But even as we're waking up, I don't feel that the politicians are reflecting that. There's a video of Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, meeting with Zelensky, who looks like he's like been on a really nasty run for a couple of days. And he's kind of kowtowing to him. I mean, It's very, very strange. So let me just say what I think we have. I think we have to start thinking differently about democracy. And I am going to be bringing you as many guests as I can on this topic. And we're going to take it apart. And I know the other TNT shows are doing that too. Patrick Henningsen always has really cool things to say on this subject. He's terribly smart. But I think we have to start thinking about something like a citizen's bill of rights. You know, we have to have a list of things that we get on the political agenda. Like, if you are elected, are you going to support our country's continued participation in the World Economic Forum? Because we don't want you to. We don't want to be part of that. What are you going to do about the next pandemic? Are lockdowns now going forward something that you are going to consider? We have to do that. We have to talk about climate lockdowns too, because that's next. And these little 15-minute city things are that, right? They want to corral us into our crappy little neighborhoods where we're trapped forever. So we have to create something that's about what we see and feel and what we've experienced over the last 3, 4, 5 years. Right. I think it started with the takedown of Donald Trump by the Russia hoax. I really do. That's what woke me up. I'm a former, almost like a socialist girl, and I've completely changed my view based in part on what happened there because I'm an actual journalist and I saw what they were doing. It was a lie, right? So I think we have to think about a citizen's bill of rights, and we have to craft something that involves all the things that are bothering us. We can ask that question. Is anybody asking politicians, has anybody, any American politician, Bobby Kennedy might be changing the equation, but nobody's saying to Biden, why are we in the WEF? The people don't want it. They're not saying that. So why is that not on the agenda? I think we can put it on the agenda. I think we can put a lot of things on an agenda if only we start speaking honestly about them. And the other thing that I think we need to really, really latch on to as well in this kind of a Bill of Rights is the idea that even as consumers now, we're treated like garbage and they get away with it. I walked into a store the other day, was treated terribly by the staff, and they had a big Be Kind sign warning the customers that if you said anything to the staff, you know, they were going to get you. I mean, wait a minute. Like what? Like we're paying for stuff. And we come in and we're treated badly or ignored or whatever. But if we say anything, we're bad people. This is how the power balance has changed, right? And I believe that Silicon Valley did that because anybody who's tried to get a hold of a social media company or the payment processor Stripe, who I'm on a bit of a warpath about right now, you can't do it. They've set up these firewalls between the customers and them. They literally have no customer service, or you're put through to a call center in Guadalajara or something, and they can't help you because it's not in the script. And they're getting away with it. They're getting away with it. So I would add to any kind of preliminary document you're thinking about creating in your local community and maybe on a federal level too, that you ask also for a consumer's bill of rights, because we are treated like absolute garbage by everybody right now. And they do it because they know that they can get away with it, and they are protected to a very large degree by the government and by woke ideology, right? That the original word Karen was not about racism. Karen was about the person who said, can I speak to the manager? Meaning, I'm a customer and I think that my questions should be addressed because I'm paying money for this service. And that all of a sudden became a bad thing with this generation coming up. It's bad to complain. Oh, don't the poor people who work there, right? So you, okay, well, I'll just take it then. So I think there is a way forward, and we're going to be talking about it a lot on this show. We're going to keep talking about COVID because we're going to do archaeology on all of that forever, because legacy media isn't doing it, because there are no inquiries about it. There was a National Citizens Inquiry here, which was completely brilliant and I was affiliated with until I couldn't be because I got too busy, but it was really worthwhile doing. But I want to really explore pushback. We can't just sit around and say, wow, this is really crap. I hate my life. We've got to, as the Better Way Conference is saying, we've got to find a way through it. And I think part of it is writing down what the problem is and forcing people in elected office or trying for elected office to deal with it and to be not afraid as we move forward, right? So that's what I have to say about that. Now, we are going to go to our next guest. Hour two is Thomas Buckley, who is writing some amazing things on Brownstone Institute, which is one of my favorite websites now. It's kind of like a New Yorker for libertarians and people who are awake to COVID and tyranny and all that stuff. It's really, and Jeffrey Tucker, who is now a friend of mine, I'm proud to say, who curates that, has a real talent, A, for writing himself. He's a terrific writer and prolific and fast. I don't know how he does it, but he's got great stuff. But he's curating a lot of really interesting people. And our next guest is one of them. So maybe what I'm going to do, I'll do a fast hello to Thomas Buckley, and then we'll probably, yeah, we're going to have to go to the news in a couple minutes, and then we'll come back. I just want to tell you a quick vaccine story, and then we will settle in and discuss with Thomas Buckley some of the wonderful pieces he has written. One of them, my favorite, was called Nowhere Man, about how isolated we all felt during COVID-19, and he wrote another one on denialism, which is this epithet they throw at us if we question anything. So I'm going to welcome Thomas Buckley now and say just a quick hello. Hi, Thomas. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. we're doing things a little bit backward today just because I wanted to get Dr. Hazen on early because she had to go. So what I want to talk to you about is some of your very thoughtful and philosophical writings about how COVID has kind of changed us both personally and societally. So we're going to go to news in a couple minutes, but if you could give me just the gist of Nowhere Man, which you wrote for Brownstone, where you talk about the primal fear of the hate-fueled mob coming to get you, burning torches in hand, and how that runs through our human DNA and how that was ignited by COVID. Just give me a couple minutes on that, and then we'll be back after the news.
Well, that was a quote from a book by Michaela Wrong called Do Not Disturb, about how the government in Rwanda, which was heroic in stopping the genocide, has become very bad itself. And it referred to pre-genocide, that all of a sudden everyone around you instantaneously changes. You go from, oh, you've got your neighbor, you've got your friends, you've got your family, etc. And by one click, all of a sudden you become an absolute stranger in a land you've never been estranged from. You become the other, and your entire group becomes the other. It is perfectly okay for all the people who, literally your neighbors, for years, to start hating you and do so aggressively. And while obviously COVID, the pandemic lockdown didn't necessarily end in violence like what happened in Rwanda and Uganda, the will to power to be able to do that was the same. The elimination of that, the automatic, I think in the article, it's like instant overnight apartheid. And without question, that's what happened in the United States. And of course, it based on just like apartheid and just like Jim Crow racism, based on wrong thing. The black people were not inherently different, like was said in the 18 and 1700s. And, oh, the people who you're discriminated against, who are complaining about your idea of COVID lockdown, they're right too. So you end up creating a very difficult cognitive dissonance, that you're being shunned, you're being fired, you're being isolated, you're being canceled, you're being censored, etc. But you know you're pretty sure you're right, which actually even makes the concept worse. It becomes even that more grinding, and the ability of the media, etc., and government officials to turn that on overnight is something that we really have to be very afraid of going future. It doesn't have to be COVID next time. The button is still there.
The button is still there. You know what? That is so perfectly sad. I was actually in Rwanda as a journalist right after it ended. And obviously it was over, so I did not see the macheting of humans by other humans. But I did move through a country that was in a state of absolute nervous breakdown and shock. And what you just described is what I experienced there and then experienced here in Canada too, exactly the way that you did. And I want to talk about that more because I do feel there's an historical precedent. And the fact that it happened so quickly and my friends and neighbors fell for it is also absolutely terrifying. So we'll be back with Thomas Buckley in a moment. Here's the news at the top of the hour. This is TNT Radio. I'm Trish Wood on The Fringe.